2014 is a possibility, but our future exploration plans offshore Alaska will depend on a number of factors.
The Interior Department reviews Shell's Arctic operations. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage School Superintendent retires after less than a year on the job.
After discussion with my family, I feel that I need to retire to be closer to them as we deal with some medical issues inside.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Department of Interior has concluded its expedited review of Shell's failed 2012 Arctic drilling campaign. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, before resuming activity in the Arctic Ocean, the company must undergo a third-party review of its entire operation.
Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar put it bluntly.
Shell screwed up in 2012.
And now the company must follow new orders from the government before it can operate in the Arctic Ocean. Shell must produce an integrated plan for future work. The company will have to detail each facet of Arctic drilling, from marine transport to emergency response to demobilization. The company also must allow an outside firm to review its Arctic practices. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Director Tommy Beaudreau says the review will need to illustrate whether Shell is capable of overseeing the contractors it uses. He says the company continually failed to do so last year. Shell contracted Superior Energy, a company with a long history in the Gulf of Mexico, to design its underwater containment system.
Ultimately, Shell, working with Superior, was not able to bring that containment system online. They were not able to obtain Coast Guard certification for the vessel, and the deployment test of the system itself failed.
That's why the Interior Department only allowed Shell to drill pilot wells last summer. Beaudreau went on, saying Shell relied on contractors for emissions controls that could not meet government muster. That led to violations of EPA air permits. And most recently, the company relied on contractors to tow the Kulik, a rig that grounded New Year's Eve.
One of the recurring themes that we identified throughout the review was this failure on the part of Shell to oversee contractors that they relied on for critical components of their operation.
Before the company can resume any drilling, regardless of the depth, Beaudreau says it must prove the containment dome can operate correctly. Secretary Salazar says the government reacted appropriately to Shell's stumbles, that the various agencies within the Department of Interior successfully managed the setbacks.
We were very much in coordination with and keeping informed daily, including I was being informed daily, on the activities relating to the U.S. Coast Guard and the matters on oversight relating to the Arctic Challenger.
Shell Alaska spokesman Curtis Smith says the company does not know which firm will conduct the review, nor did he have an idea how long the review will take. The company still says Arctic drilling is possible next summer.
2014 is a possibility, but our future exploration plans offshore Alaska will depend on a number of factors, including, of course, the readiness of our rigs and our internal confidence that lessons learned from our 2012 drilling program have been fully incorporated.
Shell sent its rigs to Asia for repair and last month announced it's suspending its drilling program this coming summer. Conservation groups are disappointed. Michael Levine is senior counsel with Oceana. He says Shell should be held accountable, but that's only the first step.
It is also necessary for the Department of the Interior to look inward and fundamentally reassess how and why it allowed an unprepared company to operate in harsh and unforgiving waters in Alaska.
The Coast Guard is conducting its own review of the company. There is no time frame when that will be released. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Anchorage School District Superintendent Jim Browder will retire in June after less than 1 year on the job, and his replacement has already been chosen. KSKA's Daisha Eden has the story.
The announcement came after a closed-door meeting between school board members and Superintendent Jim Browder at the Anchorage School District Education Center. From a podium in the center's atrium, school board president Jeannie Mackey said that she wanted to clear up any uncertainty and speculation about the district after recent events.
Dr. Browder is intending to retire from the district. His retirement will be effective 3 months from now, which puts us at about June 14th will be when he will no longer be employed with the Anchorage School District.
Earlier this month, Browder was one of three finalists for a job in Des Moines, Iowa, but he didn't get the job. Browder recently told the board that he might need to leave the district to be closer to family members who are experiencing medical issues. He's just 8 months into a three-year contract. Browder was hired in July to replace longtime Superintendent Carol Como after a seven-month-long search that cost the district more than $50,000. Mackey says Browder's contract is being adjusted to allow him to retire in order to be closer to his daughter and grandson in Georgia. Browder:
I'm proud of the numerous accomplishments that we have been able to make in this period of time. You know, this is a great school system, and in a year, we've made huge growth.
Besides working to develop the district's strategic plan, Browder is credited with helping the board make $25 million in budget cuts and with beginning to realign ASD curriculum to the Common Core standards. Mackey also announced that Assistant Superintendent Ed Graff will replace Browder. Graff has worked closely with Browder over the past months. Graff:
We've worked hard to develop a strong strategic plan in Destination 2020, and we're going to continue to focus on that, increasing the achievement for all students, as well as improving the performance for every child every year. The school district has outstanding potential, and I'm ready to lead the Anchorage School District in realizing that potential and taking us to the next level.
Graff has been with the district for more than 20 years. He's worked as a substitute teacher, an elementary school classroom teacher, and as a principal. Browder and Graff will work alongside each other during the three-month transition. Browder makes $180,000 a year. Mackey says Browder will not receive a severance package. The details of his contract adjustments will be disclosed Monday. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaskan author explores the heat, including walking on fire.
You're out the other side, and it's just very, very exhilarating. For me, it was so exhilarating, I went right back and did it again. I think I did it seven times.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The State House passed its version of the state operating budget today, trimming the governor's proposal by $100 million. Debate over the bill didn't result in any changes, but Democrats used it as a way to put their funding priorities on record. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Debate on the operating budget started in the dark. The lights flickered out, and one legislator reacted by jokingly asking if the cause was budget cuts. It turned out that someone had accidentally hit the switch, but the tone had been set. The next year would be a lean one. Representative Alan Osterman, a Kodiak Republican who co-chairs the Finance Committee, said as much while introducing the document on the House floor.
This budget begins a process of slowing the growth of state government.
The specter of declining oil production and thus declining state revenue hung over the room. At $9.8 billion, the House operating budget shaves a percentage point off Governor Sean Parnell's version and holds spending on state agencies at zero growth. It took more than 4 hours for the House to pass the bill. Democrats introduced amendment after amendment, nine in total. Some were big-ticket items, like one to increase school funding by $240 million over the next 3 years as a way of combating staff cuts. Some focused just on trying to restore funding that had initially been included in the governor's budget for things like pre-kindergarten education and behavioral health. Every one of them failed. Without the numbers to get any of their changes through, the nine Democrats in attendance used the session as a way of showing how they would like state money to be spent. Here's Representative Scott Kawasaki of Fairbanks.
The budget's a moral document, and it speaks to this legislature's priorities. It speaks to our values, speaks to this legislature's common vision for Alaska.
They argued that their amendments would save the state money in the long run. On the subject of early education, they cited studies that more funding for programs like Parents as Teachers would mean less money spent on remediation for students down the road. One legislator pushed for increasing funding for therapeutic courts by talking about how they reduce criminal recidivism, all while drawing a comparison to the film version of Les Miserables. Representative Les Guerra of Anchorage also pointed out that in total, the money that the minority caucus wanted to add to the document was still under the governor's target.
This disagreement is about 1%. With the Democratic amendments that you heard today, we would have had a budget, if they passed, less than the 1% budget growth the governor proposed. A smaller budget than what the governor proposed.
But the bottom line for the majority caucus was that looking ahead, the state just won't have the money. Representative Mark Newman, a Republican from Big Lake, described the cuts as painful but necessary.
There's nobody who wants to cut funding to kids that are disabled, mentally handicapped, the seniors. Nobody wants to do that. But it's going to get even worse. It's going to get even more difficult if we do not take steps today.
The operating budget ultimately passed on a 29-8 vote, with all but one Democrat voting against it. It will now move on to the Senate. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Huna is a big step closer to generating power from a nearby waterway, but the project developer still needs to clear one federal agency and change its rate structure to fully benefit the community. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the energy project discussed at the recent Southeast Conference mid-session summit in Juneau.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has issued a much-needed license for the Gartina Falls project near Huna. The developer is the Inside Passage Electric Cooperative, which serves the 850 population town about 40 miles west of Juneau. Jody Mitchell is CEO and general manager of the cooperative, known as IPEC.
It will displace about 30% of our diesel in Huna, which, well, we're still 70% diesel dependent, but that's very significant for the community.
The project will use a small dam to divert water from just above Gartina Falls, about 5 miles from Huna. A pipe will carry the water to a powerhouse at the falls base. Transmission lines will carry electricity to the community. Mitchell says the project is fully funded at just under $8 million, but she knows other Southeast projects have seen costs rise dramatically.
We're hoping to break ground, at least to put the access road in this year, and then install the equipment next year and hopefully have it up and running by the end of next year.
IPEC says the falls are a natural barrier to anadromous fish and the project should not impact salmon runs. Southeast Alaska Conservation Council spokesman Dan Lesh says the environmental group has no problem with the project.
We're definitely supportive of the project and in general all the communities in Southeast trying to get off diesel and trying to move on to renewable energy.
One of Huna's largest electrical customers is Icy Strait Point, an old cannery renovated as a cruise ship destination. Manager Johan Dibdahl says the small hydro project will help.
Well, that could mean a lot for us because we don't get the benefit of the PCE, of course, and so our electricity bills at Icy Strait Point run pretty high.
PCE is power cost equalization. It's a state program that lowers high electrical rates for qualifying communities. Homes are eligible, but businesses are not. Mitchell says the project faces one more regulatory hurdle from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Because of the project being on wetlands, they're requiring us to set aside an equal parcel, which is about 5 acres, to classify as wetlands and say that we won't develop it. Well, obviously, IPEC doesn't own any land, so we might have to make a visit to D.C. to try to get some help from our delegation to overcome that obstacle because I think it's unreasonable.
Gartina Falls is a run-of-the-river project. That means it makes power from whatever amount of water is flowing. It has no containment dam, which would create a lake that would help average out the amount of electricity generated. Southeast Conference Energy Coordinator Robert Venables says that's not ideal.
The highest target value resource that, you know, communities and utilities are looking for are projects that have storage capacity. So usually your lake hydros are the best.
But that's not possible for Hoonah, Cake, and some other Southeast communities, so run-of-the-river is a good alternative.
We're very excited to get some relief for the folks there in Hoonah, but this is just the beginning, not the end of meeting their energy needs.
IPEC's current rate structure averages out power production costs in Hoonah and the four other areas it serves. That would lessen the impact on the community. Mitchell says that structure is changing to a rate based on local costs. That encourages projects such as Gardena Falls that lower local rates. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2013 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 16th through the 23rd. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Competition in this year's Iditarod was nothing less than fierce. The race for first and second place was close, but there were three other competitions among top 20 finishers that were even closer. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
In the wee hours of the morning, Rookie of the Year, Your Life Seth Olsom narrowly beat out Jake Berkowitz for seventh place. As the Norwegian's lead dog, Sivo, crossed under the burled arch, Jake Berkowitz's leaders caught up with his sled.
We were running together a lot of the way. He passed me maybe a mile out. Basically, our one goal, we saw those lights coming from behind and clocked him at like 10 minutes behind us. And we just said, we got to do whatever together to get over Cape Nome and get away from those guys. So, yeah, we had a real good time out there.
Jake Berkowitz finished with 15 dogs. It's the largest team to cross the line so far, but it just wasn't enough.
He took off. I need to learn some Norwegian commands or something because they took off like a bandit.
Life Seth Olsom was all smiles when he finished. He hadn't expected to place in the top 10, let alone claim Rookie of the Year.
No, that's good. It's much better than I thought I could do, so I've been very happy with the dogs. They've been amazing.
By the time the sun came up, another close race was playing out on Front Street. Veterans Paul Gebhardt and Sim Smith battled for 15th place as their teams neared the finish line. When Smith saw Gebhardt 5 miles out, he knew his time had come.
There was a little bitty dot. Looked like I thought, that might be a dog team. And I watched it for a little while, and it was moving like a dog team, not a rock. So
a mile and a half before the finish line, Smith caught Gebhardt.
We were really rolling at that point. We were just smoking along, but neither one of my leaders, both females, had ever been here before. So they were a little confused, and they weren't sure what was going on. There were some people cheering up on the road. One of my leaders thought, oh, that's the finish line. It's got to be.
Smith had to stop his team and switch out his rookie leaders for a 10-year-old veteran. But while he was reorganizing his dogs, Gebhardt reclaimed the lead. Smith stripped off his heavy coat to run with his dogs and passed Gebhardt one last time.
I don't know that there's been a single race where I haven't picked up a place or two between White Mountain and here, you know.
Smith, a 12-time finisher, and his brother Ramey are known for their fast run times into Nome.
It's sort of a Smith thing. I guess we're late everywhere we go, so it's a last-minute thing. Just a last-minute kind of guy.
It's because the dogs are ready to go.
Ramey Smith posted the fastest time in the top 20 on the last run from safety this year.
You know, they've been nurtured and cared for the whole way, and they're finally primed to run.
A nearly identical race scenario played out for him, but this time the competition was four-time champion Lance Mackey. Mackey pulled in under the burled arch, panting, sweating, and generally flabbergasted.
That is not the guy you want chasing you.
Where did he come from?
Like his brothers, Ramey Smith's shy team bulked on the city street, so Mackey ran down the finish chute to help his competition across the line. When it was official, the two shook hands.
Where's the wings? Good job.
Mackey says he was dilly-dallying on the trail until he saw Smith's team barreling down upon his.
And I see a little dot coming down the hill. It looked like a snow machine that was going that fast. He had me hands down, and he came onto the avenue and shot straight across the road. And that was my one little opportunity to get it back.
In hindsight, Smith says he should have done things a little differently.
And I should have waited till I got on the street to catch him, and just taking it down to the wire. And waited, and then if it happened, it happened.
Ramey Smith has now finished 20 Iditarods. He says someday he'll return to the race, but he needs to recover mentally and financially from this year's run to Nome. On the Iditarod Trail in Nome, I'm Emily Schwing.
It may seem odd that an Alaskan author would write an entire book on the concept of heat. But All Things Hot is the focus of Bill Strever's newest offering. Strever is the author of the bestseller Cold. And in his new book, he explores everything from tasting crude oil to walking on fire, an experience he described as enjoyable.
And no matter how prepared you are for fire walking, when you're standing up in front of that fire, and this is a real deal, it's a real fire, and you feel the heat coming off of that fire, and you're looking down at those coals, and you're thinking to yourself, am I really going to walk across these coals in bare feet? And these coals are flaming. They're honest to God, hot fire, and you do it, and if all goes well, it doesn't burn your feet, and you walk out the other side five or six paces, you're out the other side, and it's just very, very exhilarating. For me, it was so exhilarating, I went right back and did it again. I think I did it 7 times.
You had some experiences while researching and writing the book that seemed dangerous. You mentioned the Death Valley experience. Tell us about your Death Valley experience, and how did that impact your work on this book, Heat?
Yeah, so Death Valley was fairly early in the process of writing Heat. I think when we were there in the shade, the temperatures were up around 125, 126. So these were pretty warm days. And we weren't in the shade. We were hiking out in some of the backcountry and trying to immerse myself in the heat experience and even intentionally letting myself become a little bit dehydrated and a little bit letting my core temperature rise a little bit. And it is very uncomfortable. And at the end of our first day, which was a longer hike than we had planned, with maybe a little less water than we should have taken, by the end of our first day, we both felt dehydrated and our salt balances were out of whack. And we spent the next week in Death Valley still, but feeling increasingly sick, really, from the heat. So why was that important? It's important because in my book Cold and in my book Heat, a big part of the experience, both as the writer and I hope as the readers of the book, is this immersion. It's experiencing these things through my words. I played around with fuels quite a bit in the book, so I explored different fuels that people have used and discovered that crude oil, rock oil as it was called, or petroleum, when it was first used by people, it was used largely as a medicine back in the 1800s, and people would ingest it, and they would ingest 3 tablespoons a day. So I thought, well, I guess I owe it to my readers to give that a try. So I tasted some Pennsylvania crude oil out of the first oil reservoir produced in the United States. And I also, I don't think I put it in the book, but I also tasted some Alaskan crude just to do a comparison test. Pennsylvania crude is a better tasting crude than Alaskan crude.
What's your primary goal with this work? Are you trying to draw attention to climate change, or what would you say was really, what's the main effort?
Yeah, you know, what I hope to do with my writing is to promote science as an integral part of people's lives. So I worry that people today are turned off by science. They see articles in the newspaper, and one scientist says one thing, another scientist says another thing. Most people aren't trained in those fields, or they've gone and listened to a scientist and they were bored to tears, or they bought a science book and they didn't find the science book very engaging. That troubles me. And I think we see that in the way our societies run. Science has sort of almost become something of a sideshow. And important decisions that society makes now tend to ignore science or downplay its role. So I'd like my writing to kind of promote science as something that, number one, is interesting and engaging, and number two, is mixed in with other parts of life. So when people say, is this a science book? I say, well, it's a science book, but it's about science, culture, history, and human experience. So that's what I'm trying to do with my writing, is to promote science.
It was obvious how your book Cold would be useful for Alaskans, of course. But what's there for Alaskans in heat?
Well, I hope that, like I did, I hope people see it as a continuum that might be of interest. I also think Alaskans are fascinated by heat because we're so dependent on heat and how to stay warm. And I'd like to think that people are curious enough about climate change that curiosity might extend to a broader discussion about heat and what it means to us as a society, what it means scientifically, what it means historically and culturally.
How would you gauge the concern level of most people you talk to when you discuss heat in our atmosphere? Are they concerned and motivated to do something, fatigued from hearing about it and sort of tone deaf to the problems? Are they in denial? Where would you rate people? I'm sure that the people are all over the place, but are there any predominant themes that kind of come out of it when you're talking to people?
Well, I think you're right. People are all over the place. And I think the saddest thing is that people are badly polarized. They sort of, I often have people ask me, do you believe in climate change? As though that's a sensible question. And when I say as though it's a sensible question, I mean it in a couple of different ways. But one way is that the question itself doesn't make sense. Do I believe in climate change? Sure, the climate's been changing for millions of years. Nothing new there, no news here. Or do I believe in climate change as in carbon dioxide will increase temperatures in the atmosphere? Well, yes, I believe in that too. Do I believe that we should completely change our economy overnight to fix this problem and ignore all other problems? Now we've got an interesting question. And what's sad to me is I very seldom come across people that are phrasing the question that way. They're phrasing the question in kind of a black and white rather than what can we do about this that makes sense.
Bill Strever is the author of the new book, Heat, Adventures in the World's Fiery Places. Strever says his next book will also feature a one-word title, Gold. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Emily Schwing in Nome. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Crowley, committed to Alaska for nearly 60 years. From basketball games to sled dog races, Crowley supports events that bring Alaskans together. Crowley supports what matters, and public radio matters. CPDAlaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.